if countries like Germany and France, the European Union, crack down on speech, then your Putins, your Xi Jinping's, your Erdogans and others can say, well, we're just doing what they're doing in Europe.
Jacob Mchangama, thank you very much for talking to Schweizer Monat.
Thank you, Lucas. Absolute pleasure to be invited on.
In your new book, The Future of Free Speech, you talk about a free speech recession. Where do you see this recession?
Short answer, everywhere. Unfortunately, that's the depressing reality. So you can look at empirical data where you will see that for just about two decades, really, metrics for free speech, press freedom, and so on have gone down, been in decline. And you see it both in authoritarian states. So more people live in authoritarian states. Almost all of the progress that were made since the 70s have been reverse, more people living under authoritarian regimes. And you cannot have an authoritarian regime unless you have censorship and restrictions on free speech. So those two things go hand in hand. Unfortunately, democracies as well are restricting freedom of expression. So very clearly in Europe, with more and more laws against hate speech, online regulation, and so on. You also see it in the United States, where the current Trump administration is cracking down on speech, although in the United States, you at least have a very strong constitutional protection in the First Amendment that can act as a shield.
And are you more worried about autocracies or democracies?
Well, I'm more worried, I would say, about democracies, because it's not surprising that Putin and Xi Jinping and authoritarian states use censorship. That has been the case always in authoritarian regimes. Of course, it's very worrying when democracies turn into more authoritarian states. But if you don't have democracies, strong open democracies that are the champions of free speech, then free speech will, I think, be much weaker at the global level, because there will be no credible champions of free speech to call out those states who deviate from international norms around free speech, who give support to dissidents around the world. It also makes it much easier for authoritarian states to justify their own restrictions.
Mm-hmm.
If countries like Germany and France, the European Union, crack down on speech, then your Putins, your Xi Jinping's, your Erdogans and others can say, well, we're just doing what they're doing in Europe.
Yeah, you actually talk about this in your piece for Schweizer Monat that we published recently. We'll also link to it in our show notes. And you say basically that censorship by democracies, or by the EU in that case, empowers autocrats.
Yeah. And this is not just a speculative thing. There are concrete examples of this. You saw it when Germany adopted its NetzDG law in 2017, and a first attempt to ensure that online platforms removed illegal content, which is a pretty broad and vague category under German law. Very soon, we saw that Russia, Belarus, Venezuela, other countries adopted similar laws where they were explicitly referencing the German precedent. Doesn't mean that that these countries wouldn't have done the same thing without the German precedent, but it gave them some kind of legitimacy. You see in Russia, you see that laws that for instance, ban BBC, Deutsche Welle from Russia. They say, well, the European Union has sanctioned Russia today. So we're just doing the same thing as Europeans are doing against Russian media. They're saying they have these laws in Russia which criminalize essentially denigrating Russian history, that the role of the Red Army in winning World War II. And when they use these laws, they say, well, yes, Germany and Austria and France have laws against Holocaust denial. So, you know, what's the difference?
Yeah.
In Turkey, we see hate speech laws being used by the Erdogan regime, where they point to Europe as well.
Mm-hmm. And you contrast this, and I found this fascinating, with the approach of the West in the Cold War. And you say that it was a very different approach then.
Yeah. So in 1975, there was the Helsinki Final Act. So that was essentially, it was during the Cold War, and you had the West, Western Europe, the European Economic Community, as it was then. It's not the European Union, but the predecessor of the European Union, along with the United States and Canada on the one hand, and then you had the Soviet bloc countries, come together to agree some principles on some principles, including on borders. But there were also human rights language and language about press freedom and so on. And this language, now the Soviet bloc just said, well, we'll sign this, doesn't mean anything. These are just empty words on paper. But Western democracies use this in a way to give voice and empower dissidents behind the Iron Curtain. So someone like Václav Havel, the famous Czechoslovakian dissident and playwright, was one of the signatories to the famous Charter 77, which was a very famous dissident manifesto. And they said, well, you know, the Czechoslovakian government has just signed a document which says it will respect international human rights. Well, in international human rights, it says freedom of expression is important, but it's being violated every day. And so it became a really important reference point for dissidents, one that they could use to delegitimize their own government, that could give Western democracies something substantive to criticize Soviet bloc countries. And in that way, concerted focus and promotion of freedom of expression contributed, I think, to the fall of the Soviet bloc. Obviously, it's a more complicated story than just one about free speech and censorship. But, mm-hmm. but there's a real sense that free speech was part of this winning formula that helped win the Cold War mm-hmm. for the West.
And what's the reason that this has changed? Why did the West kind of walk back on free speech?
And so I think there are a number of different contributing reasons. One being that 1975, this was sort of the beginning of the third wave of democratization. In other words, a wave of democracy that spread around the world. And it was really where the human rights, global human rights movement also came into existence. And I think there was a sense that freedom of expression was part of the DNA of Western open democracies that set them aside from especially the Soviet bloc. And so there was a pride in shared values and the superiority of these values. And it was a very stark contrast. You know, you have the Berlin Wall dividing Eastern and Western Germany, and you could very clearly see the difference between living in a country with freedom of expression, press freedom, and one where you had a totalitarian communist regime with Stasi agents snooping around, and then, you know, this optimism culminates maybe in the mid 90s, early 2000s, where you also have the internet coming along, and the idea is then that it will now be impossible for authoritarian states ever again to really consolidate their control, because the internet decentralizes speech and makes censorship impossible. That was the idea, and maybe the optimism sort of dissipates, or well, culminates maybe in with the Arab Spring, where you see social media are depicted as the heroes that allowed the people in dictatorships where strongmen had been in power for decades to suddenly circumvent censorship and propaganda. But then you have Brexit, you have the election of Donald Trump, and suddenly there's a change of narrative. It's that social media, the online sphere, spreads disinformation. It allows disinformation to decide democratic elections, allows Russia and others to undermine democracy. And suddenly there's a lot more pessimism. And I think there's also a sense in Western countries that they no longer have the same geopolitical strength that they used to have. And so they're no longer as confident in their own values as they were in the 1990s or early 2000s. Mm. And suddenly free speech becomes this Trojan horse rather than a competitive advantage vis-a-vis authoritarian states.
Mm-hmm. And what do you say? I mean, governments often make the argument that, well, with this new technologies, with social media and AI, these technologies actually increase and exacerbate the dangers of fake news and disinformation and discrimination and so on. And so we have to react to that. What do you say?
Well, yeah, whenever you have new communications technology that is disruptive, it it upends institutional authority and political authority. That has always been the case. I think, though, and there are real issues and concerns, but I think there's always a tendency to exaggerate the concerns, and also I think it's very convenient for politicians to blame problems on social media and new communication technology. No, it's not because we have not been able to provide credible answers and solutions to the challenges. It's because Silicon Valley is spreading disinformation and misleading the people. That is a very old, it's an updated version for the digital age of a very old narrative that you've seen ever since the printing press. Of course, if you go back to throughout history, you will see that the manipulation of news and media is, again, nothing new. You could take a very striking example from European history when Bismarck, the Prussian chancellor, manipulated a telegram and spread it in the media that then inflamed French opinion and then led to the Franco-Prussian War, which was instrumental for the rise of the German Empire. So again, this is not something new. Of course, in aggregate, in totality, you can spread more misinformation and disinformation, but you also get a lot more voices, and you also get better opportunities to actually try and challenge narratives that maybe before were just accepted because it was like the big, it was the media, established media, and you had a tendency to just believe whatever credible media wrote, even though you know, it might not have been the truth. Think about the New York Times and its Walter Duranty, its correspondent in the Soviet Union, someone who essentially for years misled American opinion about the scale of Stalin's, forced famine in Ukraine, leading to millions of people dying.
Yeah,
that would not have been possible probably today. You know, in an age of social media, you would have had people walking around Ukraine, filming people starving, dying on the streets, filming NKVD, Porochniks confiscating grains from Ukrainian peasants. So, you know, I maybe naively still think that we're better served with more information than with too little information. But it also is challenging. it require us to build new new habits, more skeptical, critical mindset. It requires us to build an ecosystem that optimizes for something better than just outrage and engagement, where trust is rewarded, and we're still in the early process of that, I think.
Mm-hmm. Switzerland is currently discussing a new law for platform regulation, which is based on the EU's Digital Services Act. If you could give Swiss lawmakers one advice, what would it be?
I think you should show a different path forward. Switzerland is a country which is open, more decentralized, and innovative, creative. And I think the DSA is the opposite of that. It is more centralized, top-down, with bureaucrats acting as, even if platforms have to make some decisions, it ultimately comes back to bureaucrats in the European Commission, especially for big platforms, to say, you know, have you done enough or not? I think there's a lot of different ways you could think about regulation in the online space. I would look to a country like Taiwan as inspiration for a country like Switzerland, where you empower the people, where you have a bottom-up organic approach rather than a top-down government-backed approach to these issues. And I think in that way, Switzerland could be a model, sort of saying, yes, you have the DSA model, but Switzerland has actually thought about this. We want a model that puts more emphasis on freedom of expression and access to information than the EU model. And I think that would be very much also in the spirit of the best things to come out of Europe, this, you know, having smaller states, do things differently and then work out which models work the best. And I think Switzerland could be a very interesting example of something more forward-looking than the DSA.
Mm-hmm. So you see Taiwan as kind of a role model in terms of how to have a different approach and actually strengthen free speech. What exactly does Taiwan do, for example?
Well, Taiwan obviously faces an existential threat from mainland China, and mainland China is actively trying to interfere in Taiwanese elections. And so you could imagine that Taiwan would then say, well, we need heavy-handed censorship to prevent it. But they've actually gone in the other direction and created these crowdsourced fact-checking, for instance, something that you now know that you can now see as community notes on X and being rolled out on more other platforms, where it's not, you know, you don't have established fact-checkers, you don't have the government being the final arbiter, but you create crowdsourced fact-checking with a bridging algorithm that depends on input from a lot of people with different opinions to agree on what is trustworthy information. Taiwan also fought COVID without lockdowns and takedowns. So again, focusing on trust, on bottom-up approach rather than a top-down approach. So I think there are things older democracies could learn from a young democracy like Taiwan, which faces really existential challenges, but still tries to minimize censorship.
Right. So you founded the think tank Future of Free Speech, and you also have written the most important book on the history of free speech. Now you wrote one about the future of free speech. What got you interested in this topic? Was there some specific experience that made you passionate about this topic?
Yeah, so I'm a Danish citizen, even though I live in the United States, and I was born and raised in Copenhagen. And I think for much of my life, I didn't really think that much about free speech because I took it for granted. But then, more than 20 years ago, a Danish newspaper published cartoons of the Prophet Muhammad that led to a global battle of values, if you like, over the relationship between free speech and religion. And where I saw a lot of people who had claimed to be proponents of free speech suddenly say that, well, free speech should not be used to offend particular groups. And I think that really was the moment that I got very interested in free speech because it felt it was something that affected the country that I was born and raised. And suddenly, for the first time in generations, people had to not just take first principles for granted, but really grapple with what they meant and whether they were willing to protect these principles even at the cost of potential terrorist attacks and global boycotts that could affect your security, your standard of life. That's when your principles are tested, and a lot of people failed that test, I think.
So you moved to the United States. How different are the conceptions of free speech between the US and Europe?
I mean, you can look at it from different angles. You can look at it from a legal point of view. There are very, very significant differences in the sense that the First Amendment in the United States provides much stronger protection of political speech than is the case in Europe under the European Court of Human Rights, for instance. Just yesterday, the European Court of Human Rights came out with a judgment where it said that there was a man in Georgia who had shared a YouTube video where he called the George a mayor of Tbilisi, I think, a motherfucker, and other things in that vein, and he was fined. And the European Court of Human Rights said, "Well, that's not a problem. That's not a violation of freedom of expression because these were very vulgar expressions that had spread virally and didn't contribute to any serious debate." Of course, in the United States, I just an hour ago, I went on X and I searched for Trump and motherfucker, and I found a lot of statements calling Donald Trump that and worse. And Trump certainly has tried to go after his opponents, but he's generally been stopped from doing so by the First Amendment because the First Amendment has very, very strong protections of political speech, very strong protections against defamation of public officials, and so on. And then there's the culture of free speech, where, well, I would say that in the United States, there's definitely a much stronger civil society willing to defend free expression. Lots of advocacy groups that will sue the government, that will organize protests against censorship that you don't really see in Europe. They're very, very, it's really depressing, actually. There are very, very few European free speech groups that are sort of the equivalent of FIRE or the ACLU in the United States. But it's also true that in the United States, the political polarization means that the culture of free speech is maybe eroding. More people are willing to restrict free speech. If the First Amendment did not provide the strong constitutional protection that it does, I think we would see a lot of laws at the state level, at the federal level, that would regulate, restrict free speech to go after political opponents of whichever political party is in power. So in that sense, it's not like the United States is a free speech utopia. It just has some, I think, very sensible and wise and foresighted constitutional safeguards in place. Whereas Europe has taken the opposite lesson and says, in order to avoid repeating our bloody history, we need to restrict free speech. I think that's a fundamental misreading of history and a mistake.
So what's your view on the Trump administration? I mean, Donald Trump in 2024 ran on a explicit pro free speech anti censorship campaign. Did he deliver?
No. So on his first day in office, he signed an executive order claiming to have restored free speech. Just about everything he's done ever since has been the opposite. He has sued lots of newspapers, pollsters. He's tried to punish universities, law firms, going after students for political speech that the administration doesn't like, has weaponized his the Department of Justice to, you know, go after people that have criticized him, uses regulatory agencies to go after broadcasters and so on. So I think that it's, I would say it's probably been the administration the most hostile to free speech since, you know, the Red Scare of the 50s, when there was when the US was deeply concerned about communists. But again, he has not been able to follow through on a lot of it because there's such a strong protection under the First Amendment.
Last questions. Are you overall optimistic or pessimistic about the future of free speech?
In the short term, I think I'm pretty pessimistic. I think things will get worse. That's the trajectory around the globe. But I also think that there might be like a tipping point where when all of these regulations and laws that are being adopted, when you start to see the cumulative effects of those and they start affecting ordinary people and not just, you know, extremes, then I think there might be a backlash and people will start realizing that, oh, maybe we've gone too far and we need to make sure that we actually double down on our most fundamental values. But right now, that's not where we are. It's still fear that is guiding and sort of unease about the consequences of living in the digital age. But hopefully things, I mean, it's been the case throughout the history of free speech that it's never just like a straight line of progression. There's back and forths. But I'm optimistic in the long run.
All right. Let's hope for the best. Jacob Changama, thank you very, very much.
Thank you, Lucas.